If you want to do test and learn, really, when you're at your town hall every month talking about the performance of the company, in bright lights is the failures as well as the successes. You put your money where your mouth is now and you say, guess what we learned from that?
Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guest is Fiona O'Carroll. She's been CEO, COO, MD, VP. If there's a business acronym, she has held that role. She's singularly one of the most impressive business people in Ireland today. She's been the Managing Director of Independent News and Media. She was VP of Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Group, which was actually River Deep. If you're a business OG, you'll realise that was one of the biggest mergers and acquisitions in Irish corporate history, over $3 billion. She's an incredibly impressive person, and now she's an advisor to some of Ireland's best CEOs and leaders about adopting a digital mindset. With AI and the adoption of rapid tools in the last 12 months, this could not be a better time to talk to Fiona. She's an extensive experience in the digital arena, and she breaks down what the next 12 months will hold for CEOs and leaders here in Ireland. This is my chat with Fiona O'Carroll. I've got a massive ambition for this podcast. I want to make this the number one business podcast in the world. If I'm going to do that, I've got to be world-class on every single level. And that includes having a world-class studio, which I now have at iconic offices, The Green Room. It's an incredible space. I first recorded here with my live pod back in June, and I loved it. And get this, it's publicly bookable. That means you can go online and book it right now. As I said, it's called The Green Room. It's a private cinema and screening room. That means it's perfect to wow a client with a pitch, host a private screening, or do what I do, record a podcast here. So, as I record here, and as you know, I'm a member of Iconic Offices, I've got the team at Iconic Offices to hook us up with a number of exclusive complimentary office trials and discounts for my audience for booking this exact space. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description, grab the offer that works best for you. Thanks, Iconic Offices. I'm building much more than a podcast with the Entrepreneur Experiment, and I have a very clear vision of what I'm trying to achieve. One of those goals was to get involved in funding Irish businesses, and I've just achieved that goal. I've joined the Quintus Capital team as a special advisor to the EIIS Innovation Fund. I spent the last couple of years getting to know the team, learning about the industry, and the time has come to join forces. The EIIS Innovation Fund has invested in several of the podcast guests you know and love already, such as Matthew and Katie from Squid and Peggy and Crowley of Brown Wellbeing, which has made the decision to join the fund a really, really simple one. EIIS Tax Relief provides significant tax refunds to investors who back Irish SMEs. However, the main issue with EIS is finding the right companies to invest in. This is where the EIS Innovation Fund comes in. It has an experienced management team to allocate your capital. They're now raising capital for November and December to deploy in 2024. If you are interested in becoming an investor, please visit EIIS.fund, so EIIS.fund, or download a copy of the online brochure in the show notes. Ever find yourself jumping from task to task? Sudden eureka moments at the weirdest hours, and you forget little details? Does that sound familiar? That might be ADHD, and ADHD Now are here to help. Their experienced clinical professionals conduct video consultations at your schedule and help you manage and understand these symptoms, turning them into your unique assets. Visit adhdnow.ie/fox and use the code FOX10 at checkout for 10% discount on your initial consultation and full assessment. Fiona, welcome to the pod.
Hi, Gary. Great to be here.
We've done that classic thing of having the pod before the pod.
Yes.
We had the most Irish conversation, or most Irish interaction, I should say. We were introduced by the wonderful Sharon Keegan. And then we have the standard thing after 30 seconds, discover we're neighbours.
That's the truth. Literally, what?
A couple of fields over. If I stood at the very top of my house, I could say I could see a roof. Such an Irish thing.
I know.
Not even set up. Amazing. Fiona, welcome to the pod. I'm delighted to have you here. Can you give us a quick just background as to what you do?
Yes. So, Gary, today I have a business called The Digital Mindset, which focuses on working with C-level and boards in companies that are grappling with how they transition. Companies that were really born and grew up in what we would now call the industrial era phase into this digital era phase. The challenge is enormous. So I do that. My background is in scaling businesses, both internationally, Irish companies internationally, and you know, being the entrepreneur in those companies, leading, you know, the greenfield sites, the new innovations, the new businesses for those companies, which we can get on to later, Gary, is kind of where I saw the gap being actually around mindset and not around technology. Plus why I'm very passionate about, you know, leadership in the AI era and the focus on mindset.
I'm really excited to dig into that because it literally couldn't be more relevant today. And we started to touch on that over coffee, but I kind of want to go back to kind of the origin story of, like, you talked about an entrepreneur there. For someone, and I'd imagine there is literally thousands of them listening who mightn't even know they are. What is it?
Yeah. Great question, Gary. So entrepreneurs are the people inside of established businesses of varying sizes now. They can be multinational, multi-billion dollar companies or smaller, but they are established businesses that are seeking to either go into new geographies. So these could be the people literally arriving into the geography saying, I'll find the office, I'll buy the few desks, the first few desks and computers, and I'll recruit the few staff and we'll get going. They could be literally, so a new geography, which I've done, or they are actually, the business has determined there's a new business opportunity that they would like to pursue that they feel needs to sit outside of the core business. And those entrepreneurs create and lead that business on behalf of the larger business.
I think that's brilliant because I get a lot of messages from people going, I work in a big company, but, you know, I just don't know when the time is right. I don't know if I could leave. I don't know if I could do it. So that's why I was so excited to talk to you, as kind of showing someone who's been an entrepreneur and an entrepreneur and is so enmeshed in both worlds, you can kind of like almost guide us through that path as to the impact you can have as an entrepreneur and how that's very, very similar to being an entrepreneur.
Yeah, I think the characteristics, the human characteristics of entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs are very similar. The big difference for the entrepreneurial role is that you are funded. Right. So you've all the rest to do and you have to scale it and you've all the KPIs and you've all the pressure because you were given the money and, you know, you got to make it happen. But you are funded. And certainly in my life on the other side of entrepreneurship, and we'll get on to my work with Going for Growth and all the entrepreneurs I work with, the female entrepreneurs, that's a huge difference. So just calling that out. Other than that, though, right, in my experience of being one and then spotting them and the ones who join my team and all that in companies, they are the people in the organization. You'll identify yourself. They're the people in the organization who are not happy with the status quo, right? They'll be saying, oh, there's another way to do this, or look what's coming down the pipe. Are we all aware that this is coming? It's going to hugely disrupt our business model or the way we do business or the value proposition we have, right? So they're those people. So you'll hear them in your organization because they'll always be putting their hand up saying, but I think there's another way, right? They are somewhat brave and courageous in my experience because they're willing to put their hand up to do it and they're willing to lead the change. So they're willing to go out to the front line of this new thing that's not proven, etc. Take it on. And, you know, we always say, you know, those at the front get the arrows in the back. And, you know, that's the truth, right? So there's some of that entrepreneurial courage goes on. They're comfortable enough with uncertainty, right? You've got to be with a bit of ambiguity and uncertainty. Right? We've got to have those characteristics. And the one thing you don't have the pressure of, though, is the cash flow. Right? Because you are actually funded by your corporation for a period of time. You'll usually get runway and you'll have to make some, validate some hypothesis along that runway, right? And you're funded to validate them, which is an enormous comfort, by the way, right? Because that's the big entrepreneurial world is, you know, the constant struggle with cash flow. So they're the characteristics. So then to be successful in that, though, the entrepreneurship, there's a big thing that happens in my experience. So I'm speaking generally from my own experience, is the corporate culture can hugely sabotage the entrepreneur, right? Because a few things can happen. Because it's the new thing, and anybody inside of the organization that deems that may be disruptive in any way down the road to the existing thing, right? Then we can start to see the negative sides of corporate culture emerge around power, you know, the use of resources, protection, etc., right? So in my experience, where I was most successful as an entrepreneur, I had the CEO and or a C-level absolutely sponsoring me.
Okay.
Right?
So you have to have buy-in. You have to be backed by the buy-in. Okay.
Because then what happens is when all the Machiavellian behavior starts, etc., which is inevitable, it'll end up at that level and it'll be quashed. And it'll be the new thing will be protected. It's almost Darwinian, right? The little shoots are trying to get out of the ground, but, you know, the larger beast, the dinosaur, you know, is actually crushing them. So without that level of support coming from the top to do a, let's call it a run interference and say, right, no, this is, leave that alone. Don't cut its budget. Don't take its resources away. You know, don't try to have it behave in these ways, right? Because it cannot have the same KPIs. Can't have the same KPIs as a mature business.
Yeah.
Has to have the KPIs of something that's more like a startup. A totally different way of running the business is required. And that's what I've seen be the enormous challenge. So for anybody in that role or desiring to be in that role, that'd be one of my big indicators to them that for them to be successful, they're going to need that level of sponsorship. Mm,
I think that's an incredible insight, because I think people, if they're listening, they're in an organization, they're like, oh, easy for you to say, so-and-so is doing this to me. But I think today we'll be able to give, hopefully give some insight and people going, well, this is the, maybe the other angle you should be looking at.
Yes.
How did you get into business? Like, what was your start in business and why did you kind of pursue a career in business?
So I remember doing my leaving cert, you know, and then looking at the options, and I didn't really have a big, you know, I was one of those doing the leaving cert, getting to the CAO and going, not really sure what I want to do. Where some people are so, oh, I want to be a doctor, or I want to be an architect, or I want to be a business person. I wasn't. And I saw this, it was marketing, right? And, you know, doing the career guidance teacher, and she was telling me what marketing was. And I said, you know what, I'll do that, because really the rest of them, not really that keen. So I'll do the marketing. So I did the marketing. That was my primary degree for 4 years. So then when I came out of college, what was going on was the first round of inward investment of the American multinationals was starting in Ireland. So that would have been the Microsofts, the IBMs, all them. So pre the internet companies, the Googles and Facebooks and all them, the first era of that inward investment was going on. And I was a grad coming out of college, and really I didn't know much about technology or think, oh, I'll work in the technology sector, but these were what was recruiting in Ireland. So I ended up working in the technology sector. And it wasn't by, it wasn't a plan, actually. It just happened. But I loved it. And I was like, and I actually loved technology. And I loved the creative side of it. And even though I'd done a marketing degree, I ended up running, you know, the product development side of the house, which was full of all the engineers. And normally you'd have a computer science degree, right, to do that. But I just loved it. And I got them. I understood the creativity involved in writing code, and I understood the processes, and I was able to really work the business side.
What was that though? Because to me now, you come across an incredibly astute person from a human psychology and a human nature. Even just from chatting to you for an hour, you've clearly a very keen insight into humans and human behavior. But when you're 20, 22, 23, where did you get that from? Like, how was this? Do you think you just found your thing? You said there, I didn't know what I'm being a doctor or whatever. Do you think you just found your thing? You were like, okay, I'm a marketer, but also I'm a human behavior specialist.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wouldn't have known that. So I wouldn't use those words. And just on the marketing bit, by the way, just to go back, I did obviously start in marketing. So I did actually do a number of years in a marketing job. But because I was in this fast growth American young kids, companies all arriving in here, you could move. There was a luxury if you put your hand up and said, oh, I think I have a bent for that. They'd say, all right, go over and try it. That's literally what was going on, because they were moving so fast, right? So obviously good fortune there. But back to your human question. And we get on to a thing that actually was a very big frustrator for me was I am highly intuitive. But I wouldn't have had those words there or anything. I've done a master's degree on the topic, and I'll tell you why.
So now it all makes sense.
Now it all makes sense. So what happened was, when I was in the business world originally, I didn't know that I had a particular bent to be an intuitive thinker, and I didn't know what that was. But I drove all the non-intuitive thinkers crazy, because they'd say, but where's the Excel sheet, Fiona? And how do you know that that's the way we're going to do it? And I'd say, oh, I just know that that's the way we should do this. But I didn't realize that knowing was more, there was more to it than that. Because when I went and did the master's degree, it was actually a very interesting master's degree because it was kind of like an MBA. It was run by the IMI with Trinity. I don't know if it still exists. I can't even remember what it was called, the actual MBA. But it was only 12 of us. That's it. In the whole 2 years, only 12 of us, right? And all it was really about, you had to be a GM or a CEO so that you could really affect change in your business. But it really delved into who are you? Who are you, the person leading the business? Which I'd never done, because in college and everything was all skills and acquire skills to do A, B, and C. But this was more of a spotlight on who are you, though, as a leader. So this is where the you do all these things like Myers-Briggs, the human design system, and you start identifying your type. So this was hugely helpful for me because I realized I'm an intuitive thinker and I'm driving all the non-intuitive thinkers off the deep end because they don't know how to interact with me. So I realized the onus was on me to understand my type and how I interact with the world for the good of the cause, right? It's not all about them. It's actually about me. So I had to bring it back to myself. So that was where I started the process of bring it back to yourself first, understand the way you think and why you think that way, and then interact with the world. So intuitive thinking, as I specialized in that area then, is really around, we think we have databases basically in our brain. Let's just use that word because we'll all, which is our knowledge banks. And they're historical data for us, experiences we've had, things we've learned, things we know. And they're all there. And intuitive thinkers, what they do is they scan the banks really quickly. They just have an art form of being able to scan their knowledge banks really quickly and say, this is what we should do. Right? So it actually is more analytical, if that's the right word to use for the analytical people. So once I understood that, I was able to go, oh, okay, because they tried to slow me down. And I don't do good with being slowed down, right, at all, because I'm an intuitive thinker. And it's very frustrating when people say, no, you've gone steps A, D and F, Fiona, but what about A, B and C? How did you get to D? Because intuitive thinkers have to slow down and go back through the process and say, oh yeah, I got to be this way. So I trained myself to just be able to tell how I got to where I got to. And the change it made for me, Karen, because then all the analytical thinkers who are very important, who are different, who think differently and arrive at a conclusion in a different way to me, were now able to relate to me and everyone was happy.
That's so important though. By understanding yourself, you're able to understand how others see you, and then it all starts to fall into place. Absolutely. I love that. That's, and self-awareness though, it's one of the... It's one of the rarest things in people to have the self-awareness to go look inward first and then figure out why that person has done that. What did I do to get me into this position? And then on we go. It's so rare and so refreshing to hear people even bring it up. It's actually brought up very rarely on the pod.
Yeah, and I think it's the holy grail of the future leadership. We'll get onto that, Gary, as a topic, but I really do. And because another thing I learned about myself was, and you can imagine how disruptive I was in my entrepreneur role when I was doing the following. So it's actually interesting you've brought it up again. Thank you, because I'm going to connect it to the entrepreneurship for any of the entrepreneurs out there. The other thing I did, my human design system is I'm a manifester, right? So what it means is I see the thing. I use my intuitive knowledge to go, how are we going to get that going? But what I do is, right, I move too so fast that I don't always stop to inform. It's a characteristic of manifestor. And I didn't know that I wasn't informing everyone. I was just like, whoosh, gone, down the runway, out the door, right? But I was in an environment with others who wanted to know why is she doing that and why is she doing that, even if, you know, they weren't directly involved. Right. So I learned the skill of informing. I transformed my life.
That's a big entrepreneurial thing. And that is one of the biggest traits you see. What makes you great ultimately can lead to your downfall. I've seen this so many times with entrepreneurs because they go. And they're a force of nature and it gets them to year 3, 4, 5. And then they scale. And then suddenly there's this knowledge gap because they've just gone. And everyone else is behind going, I don't know what they're doing. That? It leads to chaotic leadership. It leads to erratic leadership. It leads to people have been forced out of companies. Like it's a tale as old as time.
And if we only understood the characteristic of inform. Now, why do we not want to inform? Because I had to dig into it because I could feel the irritation levels rising in me. Like, so I had to have like a chat with myself and say, okay, why do we have this big deal about informing? But then I realized it's my type because we think it'll slow us down. So going, oh God, if I've got to go and explain it to Mary and Joe, or they'll stop me. They'll try stop me. So I won't. I'll just move. But I realized, oh no, 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 no. The shortest distance between two points is actually to inform, but to do it in a structure and to use your selling skills and to use all your great skills of how we are absolutely still going to be doing this. But now I have you on board with me, by the way, so you're not going to be a blocker down the road. You're not going to be a sniper in the bush on me later on because I pissed you off because I didn't inform. So it's an actual management tactic, I realized, was to inform. But I just didn't realize my type didn't do that until I realized.
But so many people within organizations, friends of mine who work in big organizations, I've heard them say this over and over and over. You know, I just thought by working hard, I'd rise up the ranks, but they forget the piece of, it's called politics, but really it's human nature. It's understanding, what's that person perceiving me? How has that been perceived? Do they know I'm working really hard? Is the outputs matching the inputs? And we'll get on to kind of like the future work and hybrid and all that in shortly. But bring me back to your career, bring me back, because you spent time abroad then as well.
I did. So I was most fortunate to have worked for, let's call them the American multinationals, but in the scaling part of them. So the, you like with, you know, probably one of my favorites was I got the opportunity for Vivendi Universal. So the gaming, you know, I was in the gaming industry. So I started in software Adobe. Then I moved into, at the time, it was a company that owned Blizzard Entertainment. I don't know if you know Warcraft, the World of Warcraft, mm-hmm. Diablo, all that. And they also had educational software, which will bring me on to my story of going to America. So they were going to do their European operation into Dublin. And, you know, I was quite young at the time, but I had kept up my hand up on the other side. So they were looking for a GM, right? So it was a big step for me, like, you know, to take this, to actually create the Greenfield site in Ireland that would be their EMEA, the HQ for this gaming company. So I set that up. And we ended up having to, like, I literally walked into an office and said, I have to get a desk and we better get a computer here going, right? And then we ended up with 200 people. I mean, such great joy in doing that, as all scalers will tell you. There's an enormous joy in scaling something to that size. And you see, I could control culture, remember? And this was a great luxury I learned, that I could actually influence culture because it was a greenfield site. Right. So you could have a culture within a culture. We'll come back to that in a minute. For the entrepreneurs, you can end up having a culture within a culture. If you're strong enough to protect that culture and you've got the C level support, you can actually end up with a culture in a culture, which you need, by the way, because this is much more entrepreneurial.
Bring me back to your thoughts, though, of putting your hand up for the GM role, because I hear this from entrepreneurs all the time, the self-imposter syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
And just going,
yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure if I have it in me. How did you overcome that? Because I think that's really important to kind of explore, because people will look at you and go, yeah, but that's Fiona. She did that. How did you think about it at the time?
I was like 28 years old at the time. And I remember the job coming into me from a headhunter. I remember saying to myself, now you definitely don't know enough. Right. But I'd had somebody had told me this, and it's actually apparently true. I think there's statistical data for what I'm about to say, is that, and unfortunately, someone had told me this beforehand, was that women and men, there's a difference, right? If a man thinks he can do 30% of the job, he'll say, I'm good for this one. And if women think they could maybe do 95% of it, they'll say, I'm good for this one. And it's no reflection on men. That's us, the women. So I was going, all right, I'm going to be a bit male about this one to myself, right, in a positive way. Now, I probably had 70%. But so I said, don't do that to yourself. Don't self-sabotage. Don't. You can learn. You're a fast learner, right? So then I went and I did the interview. And the whole way through the interview, like, I was going, because it was a series of interviews. I had to go to America and do all the interviews and everything. I remember thinking, every time I come out, I go, the imposter syndrome would come up and say, now, Fiona, you know you don't really know about every single detail of A, B and C, right? But obviously, I got the job. So those interviewing me said, she knows enough, right? And I think they were actually looking for that entrepreneurial spirit, to be honest, to start it. Now, then I remember getting the job and thinking, oh my God, what have you done now? Oh my God, you're after getting this job.
So even after seeing the thing.
Oh, because it's all doing the interviews, but you probably won't get the job anyway. There was my little inner critic voice.
Yeah.
You know, she was going, all right, go for the interview, but you're not going to get the job. right? But you're, go on, it'll be good experience. She was saying, be good experience for you to do the interview, but you, there's no way you're going to get the job. So all the way through, I was thinking, there's no way I'll get the job. Then I do get the job. And now my inner critic is saying, oh my God, what have you done now? This is going to be the end here, because you don't know enough about every single thing.
I think that's really important. Right? And it's lovely to hear someone say that, because I think we look at other people and we go, they've it figured out. They reached that holy grail, that land. And we think this ourselves, even though we know it doesn't work like this. We think, and I do this all the time, and I'm getting a little bit more self-aware, so I'm getting a little bit more understanding of myself. You think you'll reach this land, this day where your self-doubt goes away and you'll unlock this thing. Whereas it just brings a new chapter. You get a little bit more knowledge and you go, okay, but now I definitely, you know, and it's not about like putting yourself down, but it's about kind of going, you need to just live where you are. You need to understand where you are and not get held back by those voices. Yeah. Because even when you, this is your dream job at the time, even when you got that, it wasn't suddenly this land of milk and honey where you're like, now I'm the GM, I'm the person.
No.
It's always like, right, new day, new challenge. But embracing that and being aware of that, I think is really important. And it's lovely to talk about stuff like this because it doesn't get talked about. We look at people and we put people on pedestals. I do this all the time when I'm entrepreneurs. I'm like, oh my God, look at that person. They're phenomenal. Then you meet them and you're like, you're just a regular human.
Absolutely.
You're skin and bone. You'd scramble egg for breakfast. You know, it's all that stuff. And I think it's that's why I love doing this podcast, because it's so nice to have these in-depth conversations with people and break down the little details to go, you being honest enough and open enough to go, got the job and still didn't believe it.
Still don't believe it, you know. And then obviously you start and you start executing. And I think just to go back to your comment there, you made a good point, Gary, around that inner critic voice, etc., and how it can hold us back and how actual harsh it can be on ourselves, you know. So then you get into the area of maybe something doesn't go right. Let's call it a mistake, right? Or small level of failure, nothing catastrophic here now, and then it gets going again. Right, so what does it do? I think it self-sabotages us, but it makes it harder and strugglier is the word I use. So my kind of path I took on that, just for everyone if they're interested in the inner critic piece, was really to learn how to master it. So I call that self-mastery, right? So I was like, okay, this part of me can either get befriended, right, to use that word, or things are going to be hard for me, right? Because it keeps popping up. Every time I push the agenda or I take the next step, right, it's going to pop up, right? So if this is a part of being human, which frankly I think it is, I think to lesser degrees people have very harsh inner critics, they may not. I think we've got a lot of conditioning going on. Obviously I was a female in the business world, which was very male dominated at the time. The tech sector was 90%, right, male, particularly as you rose up the ranks now. Like once you got to GM or anything in a C-level, you could maybe be the only woman in the room. So I had a lot of conditioning around that. I think we've cultural conditioning, we've traumas, we've norms, everything that shapes us as who we are. So we're this package of stuff that we don't even know we are. And half the time, that's what we're reacting to in the grown-up world. That's what we're reacting to. And it's actually not even to do what's in front of us. So I think there's a very important part of self-awareness, self-mastery that brings more joy. So if you do that, you'll get more joy. Now, another story I'll tell you about that one. So I do my gaming thing. We scale it. We're hugely successful. I mean, we were in charge of, like, when I ran the ads, because we did print at the time. We're going back. There was still print going on. You put an ad in the paper. I just put a big picture of, I think it was Diablo from one of the games, and then, you know, hiring or whatever. And the postman at the time had to bring a truck. We were in East Point Business Park. With the CVs, right? Because it was pre-internet. Everybody was, you know, putting them in the post. So he literally, I was like, oh my God, what is in the lobby? Right? What's all that stuff in the lobby? And it was the people applying for the jobs because they could not believe we were like the first one. We were the first gaming company in Ireland, right? Big one. doing big employment. Like, and then when they'd come in for the interviews, the joy, they'd say, okay, so I'm going to do that job and you're going to pay me. Like, particularly the testers, the QA people who were all mad gamers. And they were like,
but if you're a gamer and you see this company
and you're going to pay me
in Dublin, you're going to pay you to do what you do all weekend.
Day long, and you're like, and you're going to pay me.
So dear diary, jackpot.
It was. And it taught me about that particularly. It's definitely in my top two or three things I've done. It was my first time to be the GM and scale the thing and create it. But also the energy of passion when you have a shared vision. So I learned really around shared vision. And it brings this extra energy level. It brings this dynamite to the endeavor. When everyone, the compass, and we're all pointing the same way. Now, we had a shared passion for what we were doing, which was these games, absolutely. But and that we were creating this and we were getting this opportunity and we were going to bring this out all across the world because we had everything except the US, right? And Korea, like Diablo in Korea, we did it, you know? The first multiplayer online game, the World of Warcraft, we did it, wow. Right? And it was
World of Warcraft, just for context, one of the biggest games
absolutely.
Ever.
Absolutely. Well, it was the beginning of multiplayer online. It was absolute genesis of that whole genre of gaming, right? But it was, yeah, I always have craved that then because it was the intersection of the best of human nature. Right? With this shared passion and this belief that we could do it. We could do it. We could do anything. Right? So I have had the privilege of having that, which is why I now know when it's not that. So I can go, oh no, that's not that. Right? So if I hadn't had it, you know, and I actually found a book, I can't remember, it was called The Sea Something, and it wrote about the experience that when you have this thing, this is it. And it's real hard not to do that then because you're going, this is the best of it all.
But knowing what you don't want is as important as knowing what you do want. And you have to experience both. You can't be in a bubble. And you can never, you know, some people will talk about failure / learnings, that we call them, later. But you can't shy away from that because if you never feel the bitter taste of defeat, you're never going to experience that joy. No. Because, you know, the last couple of years have been very tough for a lot of people, but I read this thing, you know, sunshine all day makes a desert. And it's very true. You can't have good times all the time. So, but then when you do get it, it's summer. You have to get out, the shorts are on, and you have to embrace that sun on your face and go, this, how is life? Life is great.
And you know what's interesting, Gary? And thanks for saying that because it's just brought me back to that time. We had huge challenges. Like, because we were learning as we went and there was a bit of winging it going on, right? And if any of those who were with me at the time are listening, they'll have a chuckle right now. And, you know, we've all been friends to this day. That'll tell you the level of bonding that went on. But it was the human belief that we could do it got us through. It was this shared connection. Got us through the really tough times, by the way. So I'm glad you brought that up. But then on to another story. So then after that, I had this real desire. I don't know where it came from, that what I did, I wanted to do it for an Irish company because I was doing it for the American multinationals. And I was like, you know what? I really want to be a part of an Irish company scaling and do it for an Irish company with an Irish company. So they were very small at the time. There was an Irish company called Riverdeep, right? Focused fully in educational software, digitizing education. So obviously my gaming bit came in now and they were looking for someone to totally head up the whole product side of the business and scale it. And it was going to scale in America. So I discover that I am pregnant, right? First baby. And it was so interesting because I was now a woman. You know, I had never really thought about myself as, oh, I'm female and I'm rising through the ranks. And I'd never kind of, honestly, because people would say, really? I say, no, I'd never realized. I just was doing my thing and we were all doing our thing. And I'd never actually said, oh, pause for a minute, because you're female rising up through the ranks in a world that doesn't have a lot of you. Mm. Right? But this was my moment to pause, Gary, because it was so, I'll never forget it because I was pregnant, right? So I'm on a train. I remember I was going to Limerick for some reason and I'm on a train and I open the newspaper. It's still the old world, right? I open the newspaper and there's this job. I was an executive vice president. Now we're talking serious C-level role here, right? Blah, 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 the job. And I read it and said, oh, that's me. Whoever actually wrote that, this wasn't even an imposter syndrome moment. This was, oh no, I actually tick every box here. But it would be my love now. This job was written for me. And it was going to be the love of my life, this job, right? So I go home, but I'm pregnant, you see. I'm pregnant. And I'm maybe 4 months pregnant now. First baby, no experience. So I'm in the kitchen and I'm like saying to my husband, I said to him, God, I saw this job today. You know, it's honestly, it spoke to me through the newspaper. It said, Fiona, this is your job, right? But should there be no point in me applying for it? Just limiting beliefs.
There's that voice. Yeah.
The limiting beliefs, right? But it was very much cultural conditioning that I had absorbed and it was in me because there's no way. They're not going to give a pregnant woman an executive vice president role in the company, blah, blah. Right. So my husband, who's a very advanced, evolved male, said, like, who am I speaking to? He said, hello, Fiona, can we pause for a minute? He said, what about everything you've accomplished and everything where you're an absolute fit for the role? And I said, oh, no, it won't be about that. It won't be about that. It'll be about that I'm pregnant. And he said, well, I'll tell you what now, if I was you, I'd apply for the role. If they don't want to employ you because you're pregnant, you don't want to work for them. I said, very good point. So I needed someone to give me an absolute joint jolt of my own mindset. So, of course, I apply for the job. So I get the first interview anyway. Maybe, you know, on your first baby, you're not that big at the very beginning, right, towards the end, right? So maybe I'm 5 months pregnant by the time. Like, I definitely have a visible bump, right, on the interview. So I go into the interview. It was so funny because I remember in the kitchen saying to my husband, going, well, talk about the pregnancy. What do you do? Do you say something about the pregnancy? I don't know what to do. I've never been. He said, you don't talk about the pregnancy. You're going for the job to do a job. Whether you've got a bump or not bump is not a topic of, in my opinion, I don't know what the hell you bring that up for. I said, no, fine. I know rail posts. What do you do in this situation? So in I go anyway, no problem, do the interview. So obviously it's going to move up eventually to the CEO of the company. It's a very important recruit. They're scaling in America, etc. But this CEO is traveling the whole time. So I'm not a lie. I am now like in the week before I'm having the baby. So it has taken this long. So obviously the bump is enormous.
So you're going through different rounds.
I'm going through all these rounds and it takes forever. It's taking like 5 months to get through the interview process because of the nature of the CEO being in the States all the time, scaling the business. And of course, we're going to be meeting in person. So anyway, I go in and I never forget that doing the interview. And I bless him. He must have been told by HR, do not look at the bump because if you don't want to employ her, there'll be all kinds of issues. And in fairness, we're great friends to this day. He was trained not to look at it. It was so cute because I
couldn't move thinking, for the entire interview.
I was thinking,
at you.
God, should I just bring it up so he'll feel a bit more
relaxed?
But
misery.
At this point, we've not brought it up. I'm saying nothing. So I actually go home that night and go into labor, Gary. That's how pregnant I was at that interview.
No way.
I go home that night and go into labor. And then 2 days later, I'm in, baby in, you know, in the hospital, the baby's in the little cot thing beside you. And I get the call and they'd offer me the job.
But how beautiful is that story,
yeah,
though?
It's because a great story, but it's also how my own limiting belief about myself, though. It was just back to that limiting belief voice. And I think because my energy going in was not with my limiting belief, I wasn't projecting about it. But I had to, like, it was a very new experience for me, but it was also, yeah, and of course the rest was history then. And I stayed with them for 10 years. So I was 10 years with Riverdeep because it was the most incredible journey because we were tiny. Then we made a huge series of acquisitions in California. I moved to San Francisco, babies one. We moved myself and my husband to San Francisco because we're scaling in the US. And I'm there for 5 years and we eventually did the second largest, I think to this day, could be wrong, second largest reverse corporate takeover in Irish corporate history where we bought the very large American company. So the small, now we were big at this time. We were probably doing about 400 million in revenue ourselves.
Wow.
But the thing we bought was 4 billion in revenue. And it was called Houghton Mifflin, Harcourt. And it was a big book publisher. And we knew they had position advantage because they were in every school. They had all the content, but it was in a print format. But we had the digital capability. So putting the two together, we could digitize the whole lot.
Explain briefly to people who won't understand what that is. You reverse mergered. What does that mean?
Oh, what it means is it's where the smaller company actually acquires the big one. And it's called a reverse corporate takeover because it's normally the other way around, where we took the big company and we bought them rather than them buying us. It was the other way around. So the small company bought the big company.
How does that happen?
So at the time, we're pre-crash. So we're pre-2008. So you were able to raise a lot of cash. It was like debt. So you're able to raise a lot of debt financing, right? And then obviously the other company has to agree and et cetera, which they were more than happy to do because they were all able to exit them. We're able to exit the business. The senior team in that company, some of them were able to exit and they wanted to. So, yeah, so that's how it happened. And then we moved the HQ of everything to Boston because that's where the Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Company HQ was, right? And then I moved back to Ireland because we decided to put the entire R&D centre for the entire group into Dublin. Down in Pierce Street, still there.
Oh, wow.
To this day.
Really?
Yeah, down in Pierce Street, yeah. Still there to this day. Yeah.
What a story.
Yeah.
That could be a pod on its own. I feel like we could do a whole episode on that time span. That story though, sorry, I'm still back in the room with you doing the interview and then having the baby that night. Like, what a remarkable story. And what a refreshing story. Because you hear a lot of bad stories about female entrepreneurs not getting put forward and not getting those chances. So I think it's really important to share that and kind of like explore it. You put yourself in the room. You put yourself in the room and you didn't listen to that voice. But it also shows you how important it is to have people around you that push you forward. I think that's overlooked a lot. Because as you were talking there, I was thinking about the inner voice. Like, I never even knew I had an inner voice until I started working with Shane Craddock. He's an executive coach in Wicklow. And I was like, oh yeah, the inner voice. And he's like, but that's not you though. I was like, oh, but I thought that was just my thoughts. He's like, you can control the inner voice. And we kind of explored it and went through it. And, you know, you touched on it there, but I think it's really important to talk about. Like, you touched on how you speak to yourself. You'd never speak to someone else like that. You'd never run them down in that way. You'd never go, you're not going to be qualified for that stuff. What would you say to your friend? You'd be like, go for it. What's the worst thing can happen?
Absolutely, Gary. And there's a wonderful author, Michael A. Singer is his name. He's my favorite. And I use his term now because it burst out laughing when I was reading his book. He calls that inner voice the mad roommate. I was like, oh, I love that.
Exactly.
It's the mad roommate forever. He was saying when you start to listen to the mad roommate, the shower is a good place for some reason. They can get quite loud there. And you're starting to listen to them. You go, if it was your roommate, you'd ask them to move out. You're like, I'm sorry, I'm not living with you. This isn't happening, right? So, yeah, it's amazing how much the mad roommate can rule the roost. And I always say to the people I work with then is now that I've kind of had to master my own mad roommate, I'm like, okay, who's driving the bus? Right? If the mad roommate is driving the bus, we are going to be in big old trouble, right? If she's driving the bus. So who's driving the bus? And I think you're absolutely right about the voice, because there's another great, I'll take his phrase, Eckhart Tolle is his name. And he would say, if you can observe something, then you are not it. So just ponder on that one. Mm-hmm. And that's your mad roommate. So if you're observing to your coach, to what your executive coach said to you, if you're observing the mad roommate, who's observing? Now, that's another podcast, Gary, right?
But we're going deep. I hope everyone's having a coffee when they're listening to us going, okay, I'm going to pause, I'm going to think about that for 5 minutes and
that's
back to Gary and Fiona.
Yeah, it's a big one.
But these are the conversations you want to have, right? Like, because, you know, often, and that's why I love doing this podcast, because often people mightn't have those people around you. They mightn't have the partner that says, go for it.
Yes.
And I like to view these pods as being the other person in the room.
Yes.
I always picture someone else sitting here with us. Well, Ben is sitting here, obviously, but I also picture someone else going, I'm having that challenge. That's made me rethink about how I view that. And I think especially for female founders, I spoke to Sharon and I spoke to Chupi and now yourself this week. When you see the extra hurdles that you have to go through and the extra challenges, and then if you're adding more challenges to yourself, you know, you're already going to have a battle on your hands. But if you're already putting yourself out of the battle before it begins, it's 100 times harder.
Yes, 100%, Gary. Absolutely.
So with River Deep, you came back to Ireland, set up the R&D here. And that was 2008, 2009. So that would have been an interesting time to come home.
It was a very interesting time because we were quite oblivious to the crash. You know, in Ireland, really, the depth of it until we moved home. Well, no, sorry. What we were more oblivious, because we had lived in Ireland, we weren't as aware of the stuff that was happening pre the crash. The property, the price of everything, the, you know, so therefore what happened to people afterwards, you know, the fall was so big. So we came back in when it was all happening, when the crash was happening. So it was an interesting time, but it was a really amazing time. And I know the CEO of Riverdeep at the time, who is Irish, felt a great sense of, and we all did, because there was a large part of the, we all moved to San Francisco, like the management team, so there was a big chunk of Irishness coming back. That we could put the R&D centre into Dublin at the time because it was 200 really high-end jobs, right? At a time when Ireland was, it was not looking good. So it was a great joy that we could come back and do that at the time. And it just happened to coincide with that going on. And it was a really good news story for Ireland at the time and, you know, lifted everyone a bit. And it was in the news and people were talking about it because it was the opposite kind of story to everything else that was going on at the time. Yeah. And so then from there, Gary, another big thing I do I work with a group called Leadership for Growth. I started it when I got back, right? And what is that? Going for Growth. Sorry, we'll talk about Leadership for Growth in a minute. Going for Growth, which is was founded by an incredible woman, Paula Fitzsimons, who could see the challenge for female entrepreneurs because we're going back now. She set it up before I got back, so it's pre-2008, but she could see the challenge. And she wanted to put a program together to fully support female entrepreneurs on their journey. Right, of starting, scaling businesses out of Ireland. So she put together a program where it is like 6 months. You come on the program, you apply. It's very competitive. You apply to get on. And then there's experienced females who've been there, done that, you know, bought the t-shirt, both in either entrepreneurs, that mix of people who come in, and then they take 8 of these female founder companies and work with them for 6 months. So it's a very structured program. And like Chupi, Shar, everyone that you just met, they're all graduates of that program, right? A lot of the incredibly successful female entrepreneurs right now have come through that program. So I would still do that today. I volunteer. It's a volunteering of your time. It brings me great joy, incredible insight, amazing women. I learn all the time from it myself. So I do that. And then the other thing I have created is my own business, which is called The Digital Mindset, right? Now, what was that born out of? That was born out of, I had been obviously on the front end because of the entrepreneur thing and obviously in gaming and at Riverdeep, you know, it was very bleeding edge. We were innovators, right? But then I ended up in more traditional companies when we bought the print company. I was like, oh, wow, trying to move this now, because we ended up, there was 4,000 employees in that company and we had 400. So we were outnumbered 1 to 10. So even though we were the acquirer, the bigger culture won. That was a very interesting insight for me. We were a little bit naive about that, right? It was so large, there was like a cultural lock-in and they won. And so I found myself now trying to be the entrepreneurial thing inside of the traditional culture. I was like, oh my God, this is really hard, right? Because of mindset, not technology. We had all the technology. So Riverdeep had it. It wasn't about technology. It was about people and mindset. So I lived that journey. That was quite a few scars trying to make that happen. Then I joined INM here in Ireland after Riverdeep, after all of that, because at the time, of course, the whole disruption.
That's Independent News Media
Media for everybody. The independent newspaper, right? That the Indo, as we'd all know it here in Ireland. It was going through its disruption phase now because obviously internet was well and truly rocking and rolling. The business model was being disrupted. The classifieds were gone. You know, all of that had gone because all the other, you know, the employment company, you know, they'd all set up. All the digital companies had come and taken the classified business. So they'd already missed that. And then, of course, now we're looking at how are we going to digitize the actual newspaper. So I joined them. and was worked on the digitization of the app that is independent.ie today. But again, was in the very traditional culture, you know, and could see the enormous struggle for people when you're in the thing that's 100 years old and we've been doing it this way. And now we've this new technology thing coming along. And, you know, the struggle is enormous, right? But again, it's people and mindset. It was not the technology to do. And an app called Independent.ie was such a low tech endeavor, yeah. Right? Even then, it was a reasonably low tech endeavor. So my biggest learning from all of that was that it's not actually about the technology. It's actually about the people and the mindset. And if you don't get that right, particularly at the C-level and board and C-level first, because it rolls downstream, no matter what, every company, that's the same. If you don't get that right, the likelihood of success is hugely diminished. It's going to be really hard anyway, by the way, right? Once you're going through a disruption, and we're going through a massive one, because what I always tell everybody, just to kind of get everybody feeling, this is hard, so it should be hard and don't worry about it, it's hard, is... we're in an era shift. We're in the throes of it. Depending on what industry you're in right now, you're well over the hill in it now, by the way, of what I'm about to say, because we have shifted from the industrial era to the digital, let's call it slash AI era now, just because it's all the same thing. But we'll just bring that word in because it's topical today. This is enormous because history's only being written right now. We are the change agents right now in this era. We are it. It is happening around us, to us, alongside us as we move through it. We do not know what the outcome is. We don't have crystal balls. So, but if we drew if we were to go back now and interview the people, they'll be all dead now. But if we were able to interview the people going from the agricultural to the industrial era, we'd be hearing the same thing. I put my money on it, right? Because it's so huge to make this era change. Everything's changing. The way we do things, our business models, most importantly, by the way, our business models are being disrupted, right? How we make money, how the company actually makes money, right, is being disrupted, as well as how we deliver our value propositions, how we run our companies, how we work with our employees. Everything is up on the table. So that is huge. And I think it's okay. I think it's really good to say that to everyone, because then they can go, oh, it's okay. It is huge. It's a wonder I feel overwhelmed.
I think everyone's overwhelmed. I mean, post-COVID, you know, now we've two wars, and I think the world is shifting. And people are doing exactly what you say. They're fighting against the dying of the light, which they see as this extinction event, when in reality it isn't. But when you just, I speak to a lot of entrepreneurs and company owners, and it makes me nervous because they're doing nothing. They're just trying to have the status quo. So they're like, we're afraid to do anything because, you know, a recession or AI or this and the other. And they're just doing nothing. And you know yourself, if you ain't going forward, you're going backwards.
Absolutely.
It's phenomenal. I think we are at a landmark shift in the world.
We really are. And the big thing I would say to everybody is, what's different right now is the speed. The speed at which it's happening. Let's even take a simple example, because we all know this one. Let's take the chat AIs, right? ChatGPT or whatever one, right? Like, look at the speed of adoption of that thing over the last 5 months. Everyone has it in their pocket. Like, this is what I mean by speed. Where if you went back 3 years, 5 years ago, the speed of adoption was maybe 2 years for something like that.
Yeah.
3 years. We're now down to months. Within the first month, I can't remember the stats, but it was unbelievable.
It's one of the fastest growing digital apps of all time.
So the speed of what is changing around us is so fast, we mightn't even see it, to be honest, because it's so fast, right? And for anyone who's interested, just to get there's a fantastic new movie out. It's about the BlackBerry story.
I think it's called BlackBerry.
I highly recommend you watch it if you're thinking about the status quo. If you're somebody who goes, status quo is okay, just watch the movie. It's a brilliant movie, by the way. I just watched it on a plane. So I was like, oh, but I was going, oh my God, yeah, this is the poster child for the status quo. Let's just keep doing what we do and we won't do anything else. So I highly recommend that one. But yeah, and I think, like, let's look at the human nature. So back to the human nature side of it, you know, I always talk about we've lots of cognitive biases. It's part of being a human being. So we're all here having a human being experience, right? So we are one. So that's why we must understand that side of ourselves in an era shift, because it really can cause us to fail if we do not, right? And One of the ones that I talk about the most when it comes to the cognitive biases is one called path dependency. Okay, there's loads of biases. I think some documented 80 of them or something. I don't know what the exact number is. This one, there's others, but this one. Because path dependency is a human orientation. So you are not unique. It's a human orientation to stick with the tried and tested and what we know. Right?
If it ain't broke. Right? All these cliches are there for a reason,
absolutely.
Right?
They're there for a reason.
Keep now, trucking.
So if you don't know about that, because we're not doing self-reflection, or we're not going to the mindset side of the house, right? We're just focusing on the skills side of the house, which, frankly, I think leadership development needs. We need to champion a new era in leadership development, right? Which balances both the skills that we build as leaders to be leaders, along with the mindset, self-awareness side. Mm. And they should be 50-50 minimum, right?
Skills are going to get you in the room. The mindset's what's going to get you to the next room.
And we're in an era shift, right? So we really want to have deep self-awareness, right? Because we've got to be able to know, oh, I'm having a path-dependent moment right now. Mm. I have to be able to self-reflect, particularly if you're a leader of the business. Particularly because you are influencing the behavior of everyone below you, right?
If you're seen to be hesitant, if you're seen to be scared, if you're seen to be, it's grand, keep going.
That's what we're going to do.
That's what people will do.
Yeah. So, that's a big part of going through the airship. So the digital mindset then, you know, that I work with companies on right now is I heavily focus on that, right? I talk to them about, look, there are ways you can manage in uncertainty and there are tools you can use, you know, how you go to the future and plan back with all the uncertainty. So all the tools are there. We talk about those and strategy tools and how would you execute? Absolutely. But I say the precursor to all that, though, is that we have the mindset right. Because no matter what, the mindset will put a shadow over the strategy. How many beautiful strategies have found themselves in the drawer with the dust on them because we blocked the execution of them? Right? We can do that on a macro level. We can do that on an individual level, which we opened on blocking ourselves. But guess what? We're doing the self-sabotage. We're just now doing it at the corporate level because of our own mindsets and how we're behaving. But we're just not aware. People are not aware that they're doing it and it needs to get exposed. You know, oh, did you know there's a thing called path dependency? When I have this conversation with people, they're like, oh my God, yes, I do recognize. Okay, now I can start to recognize.
You recognize it, but you don't have the name for it, or you don't...
You don't even know it's a thing.
You think it's just in your head, or you think it's just you. Like, this is the exact same, and so I was so excited to have this conversation. It's the exact same for entrepreneurs. You know, everyone has these things. You just approach it in different ways. Like, technology is changing so rapidly, but humans don't really fundamentally change. What you do is the self-awareness piece. And I think it's understanding that it's okay for change. Change is going to happen.
Absolutely.
But do you embrace it and go, right, could my role be commoditized? Even just taking that for yourself, that self-awareness piece, could what I do be commoditized? And could this be done by an AI? If it does, what do you do then?
Yeah.
You don't just panic and have fear. You think about, right, what can I do next? What's next for me?
Yeah, because there's a few things, Gary, just came to mind when we talked about that. Like, we have to teach our organizations resilience and in things that are changing so fast and an era shift. And a big part of that is that we have to be very comfortable with uncertainty and ambiguity. And most people hate uncertainty and ambiguity.
Yeah. People would prefer a horrible certainty to an uncertain pleasantness. Yeah.
Right?
It's
so
just.
We have to put. Actual, I'm a system thinker, like I like structure. And people would say, oh, well, uncertainty, ambiguity. Yeah, you could structure for that. You could put structures around how we're going to think, how we're going to plan, what are the signposts, right? What will we, how will we make a map for uncertain territory? What signposts will we plot along the way? I mean, there's a whole methodology for managing an uncertainty. Right? Because people think when they hear uncertainty and ambiguity, oh, it'll be the Wild West. I hate the Wild West. I mean, I've always been the entrepreneur, and I will never do Wild West because I'm a system thinker. So I will make a process and a structure for managing uncertainty. Right? So I think that gives a lot of relief to people because when you're running a business, the pressures that are on you, right, are huge. Deliver results, you know, optimize the return on investment, deliver, if you are publicly quoted, we have the share price, yeah, right? All these very, very hardcore, corporate financial KPIs that you've got to deliver. And then we tend to, if someone starts talking about uncertainty and ambiguity, people get in a panic. So then they realize, oh, you can actually structure for that. And we can actually train people to actually operate and execute in these environments.
If people haven't realized this after going through a pandemic, I think they'll never realize it. Because if you can't understand, well, that'll never happen. That should be gone from your lexicon. That'll never happen. I didn't see that coming. They should be gone. If you're in business and you say that, get a new career. Because that is the only thing certain is change, right?
100%.
And people have this misconception about entrepreneurs in particular, that they're these, like you said, the Wild West. They're these gunslingers. They're these risk takers. There's this myth. There's a kind of this movie TV myth of like burn the boats all in. He risked it all. She risked it all. They're calculated risk takers. The best ones. The best ones calculate on what's the downside here? Because we spoke about over coffee. It's your livelihood. It's your family's livelihood. It's your kid's future. You ain't throwing the dice every day on the floor to try roll two sixes. You've been very careful to go, okay, if I roll two ones, we're still fine. And that's where great entrepreneurs and great business people go and go, what's the downside here? Can we mitigate that? If we can mitigate it and we can live with the worst case scenario, brilliant. Everything else is upside.
And what they're really, really good at too is, and I'm going to take this phrase down a level because everyone goes, oh yeah, we all know about that test and learn. Okay, so let's talk about that. Because you don't have to bet the farm. Everybody thinks you're betting the farm. You're not. The brilliant entrepreneurs, also the ones now scaled and have the multi-million dollar organizations, absolutely got that they had to bring in structure and scale. They absolutely understood what has to happen to actually have an organization function. But they didn't lose the ability to innovate along the way, right? Which happens sometimes, right? They didn't lose that. They kept it going, right? Now, we've obviously got the poster children like Steve Jobs and all the rest, but there's loads of them sitting here in Ireland now, do you know what I mean, that we could name, that have done this and aren't Steve Jobs, right? And what they've done is they've been able to keep the innovation going because of the concept of test and learn, which is calculated small bets until we get to... It's very scientific, actually. I love test and learn. So just for all the people who need a formula, there's a scientific formula to test and learn, which is we set a hypothesis. If you're in a science lab, you do the same. Science is hugely uncertain when you're in the test phase. Very same. So we set the hypothesis of what we think. We say, here's a mile. You know, like if we go this far down, we'll have more data and then we'll know, will we go left or will we go right? It's as simple as that. Test and learn. Now, why does test and learn not work? Right? Why test and learn doesn't work is, in my opinion, when it fails, is because conceptually everyone goes, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, we're going to put 100 grand on the table, 200 grand, whatever, 50, 10, doesn't matter, whatever your thing is. But then they start sabotaging it as they move along. So we all agreed the signpost would be A, but we start meddling in the journey, right? We don't get to the signpost. That's number one. We start withdrawing support for the experiment. And thirdly, the worst thing at all that I see going on is those who were brave enough on your behalf to run the experiment, if it fails, and we'll come back to the word failure now in a sec, then they pay the price. So now the whole organization who is watching this and observing this, right, pulls the reins in and says, well, I'm not going to go out on the ledge like Johnny did and do the experiment because guess what? Somebody pays the price around here. This is what's actually happening on the ground. This is a leadership problem. Right? Is this your problem? So they're, yeah, well, oh, it's great. You know, I went to some seminar on test and learn, right? And then we go try to do test and learn and we shoot everybody who's doing the test and learn and then we kill test and learn in the company. Where I say to the CEOs, if you want to do test and learn, really, when you're at your town hall every month talking about the performance of the company, in bright lights is the failures as well as the successes. You put your money where your mouth is now and you say, guess what we learned from that? And I want to give accolade to Team A because we were going down this road with hypothesis A and we determined that is not the way to go. And if we hadn't done that, guys, wait till I tell you what would have happened. So they're getting gold stars. And guess what? The guys over here who just won the big deal with Company A, they're getting gold stars. Everyone's getting gold stars. It's the only way it works because then it's real, right, in the business as opposed to... Also then, Gary, we were chatting at the coffee about that word failure, right? Oh my God, like you say that word failure to people and like their body language changes. Like you immediately see, oh, like it mightn't work though. Really? We'll do the test and learn. But is there a chance it wouldn't work? And you're going, well, yes, that's why it's called test and learn, is because we want to only spend 100 grand to realise what 5 million of a problem would have been had we kept going. Yes. So we may say we spent 100 grand and we decided not to do that anymore. And they're like, their body language, they, you see the sweating, you know, starts coming through the pores on their forehead. And now you know, okay, we need to have another chat now. It's a different conversation. It's gone because you are hugely triggered by the concept of failure for some reason, which is multidimensional.
That's the whole concept of this podcast. I'm going to clip this and use it as my trailer. That's the whole concept of this podcast, the entrepreneur experiment, because that's all business is. Many experiments run every day, every hour, every week, every month. Test, learn, tweak, test, learn. That's all business is. And when you strip it down, business is problem solving and testing.
100%.
That's it.
100%, Gary. And so then what happens is, you know, we've got to go and deal with our fear of failure.
Where does that come from?
Like, well, it's multidimensional. Like,
we're humans and humans hate failure, but especially in Ireland, not bash Ireland or whatever, but look, there seems to be a bit of an added edge to failure here.
Yeah, it's a complex one, right? I'll tell you, I lived obviously in San Francisco, the Silicon Valley, right, for 5 years. So it was a badge of honor if you tried something and it didn't work. If you went raise the money and you hadn't already had a failure, as they called it, tried something and it didn't work, they were less likely to fund you because they'd say you didn't try hard enough, you didn't risk enough, you didn't push the edges. This would be now the tech funders, obviously. So that's the Silicon Valley tech funders, that really funding uncertainty, comfortable with funding uncertainty, knowing 1 in 10 will be a hit, that model, right?
If you look at it in any other industry, if you're going to have heart surgery and you have a heart surgeon who's done 20,000 operations and you have a heart surgeon who's done zero, which one are you picking?
Exactly.
Let's take business out of it, right? Because people, you know, don't, this idea that it's not real, it's real. Which would you prefer?
Absolutely.
If your heart was on the line?
Absolutely.
You'd go for the person that's done 20,000. You just would.
But it was very interesting when I came home to Ireland then, Gary, because I was all in the failure word usage.
Yeah.
But I'd see the faces if I was doing the town hall. And I mentioned the word failure, I'd see the whole room tighten up, the team
stiffen.
I was like, oh God, we'll have to work on this. So what I did was I replaced it with the word learn. So I said, we're going to test and learn. And then whatever the outcome is, it's the learning we're after. What did we learn from that experience, experiment? What did we learn? And well done, learning is positive, negative, neutral, doesn't matter. It's all learning and it's informing what we do next. So I took the word failure out and I replaced it with learn. And I felt, I don't know if that's a global thing. Certainly, obviously, Silicon Valley is its own little universe. But definitely for me in Ireland, I found the word learn and then the people could calm down.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were feeling much better. So I don't know what it's rooted in our psyche. I hope our next generation coming up aren't as rooted in it. I don't know.
I think they aren't, because just from anecdotally chatting to like people of a younger generation, like they're so quick to pivot and so quick to move and so quick to learn. Like there's a young entrepreneur, he's over in London now building in the AI space. My God, they will change in the hour. They will be gone in a new direction in an hour. And I don't mean people are so funny. There's this, oh, the new generation, ah, they're terrible. Like such an antiquated mindset. Like, no, they just have a different way of doing it. And I think a lot of it is better because they're not anchored. They're not afraid. They're not worried about, like, they'll change the next day. He texts me the other night. He goes, oh, we have to pivot the company. OpenAI just announced that they've just announced a free add-on that'll take away our entire business. And he just goes, pivot, lol, move on. That was it. And that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Because they're the people that'll be building the next generation of companies.
Yes. And I think as well, you know, we can tie our identities to our companies, which is really hard then, because if there's this super voltage around failure, then it seems to be, we feel it's attached to our identity, right? Which is very hard for entrepreneurs or business people, whatever field you're in. And I think that's really important because we haven't had a culture, I don't think, of when something has not worked out for an entrepreneur of being highly supportive of that in the public arena. And hopefully it's changing. But historically, which then will create fear for others because they're like, oh my God, if that happens to me, this is what's going to happen to me in the public arena.
Yeah.
So I think it's multidimensional. That one.
Yeah, I think it's a huge one. We're going to get to our quickfire round in a second. But thank you for being so open about all that because I think they're the conversations you want to have. And I think that's what does foster change is that the openness of just getting it out there, just having these conversations because, you know, Not everyone has access to mentors like you. Not everyone has access to people like you. And I love by having these conversations with people who are able to dig into this and go a little bit deeper. It's not just about, you know, business. It's about the mindset and it's about psychology. So thank you for being so open because not everybody is. Going to
pleasure,
do a quick
you.
Fire round. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur should read?
Well, the one that was very important to me as I made my leaps along the way is a book called The Big Leap. And it's by Guy Hendricks.
Okay. That has never been recommended. So thank you.
I highly recommend it. And three big takeaways out of the book. It really helps you understand the upper limits you're putting on yourself because of your beliefs and how you're thinking, right? Another concept that has been liberating for me that came from that book was the concept of your zone of genius. So what happens a lot of us, we get caught in our zone of excellence. Like I'm excellent at certain things. Everyone is, right? Their skill sets. But my zone of genius is actually my passion and the thing that I'm here to do. So it really talks about that. So for anyone maybe who's even thinking of taking a big leap, brilliant. I would put it on four times, like when I'm doing a leap, because it just gets me through the leap if my inner critic is activated. And the other big concept is you are 100% responsible for your reaction to everything.
Big believer in that.
So I love the book.
No one can make you feel a certain way. It's your reaction to the feeling.
Yes.
I love that. We've definitely read a lot of the same books. What's something you didn't pay enough attention to early on and had to learn the hard way?
I referenced it earlier, was understanding my type. Remember the Myers-Briggs, the human design, the self-awareness piece. And it made it strugglier and harder for me in execution.
What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
I think definitely the big one would be your personal time, because I would have done a lot of travel, you know, it eats into your personal time. I don't think I thought at the time that it was a painful sacrifice, you know, but in reflecting, it's definitely what I was sacrificing.
Mm. What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
You know, Gary, that I would absolutely put it into a fund for female entrepreneurship. I would go after up and coming top, you know, I know you had Chupi on talking about the funding of women for female entrepreneurs. It's a statistical fact.
Mm.
It is what it is. And I think how we'll move the dial there is actually having funds that go after supporting female entrepreneurship.
I'd love to see that launch in Ireland because I think there is definitely a gap there. I think there's definitely, I'd love to see that launch because I think Chupi has a beautiful way of explaining it. You know, it's about change, but it's also about the profits that come from change. I think once those two, like it just has stuck with me. She said it to me last night, but it stuck with me. And I'm like, that's it. You just link those two together.
Exactly. And we need some catalysts for the change, which is the funding.
Yeah.
And others, but it is one.
Keep an eye on that one. That could be your next, next leap. I know you'd have heard it here first. What's something in your daily routine you wish had started sooner?
Oh, without a doubt, meditation.
Interesting.
Without a doubt. I'm probably a 10-year meditator now.
Oh, you were doing it before it was cool then.
I was doing it before it was cool. And you know, Gary, an unknown fact, I've actually trained as a meditation teacher.
Okay.
With David G in California, amazing meditation teacher, because I got into it and was like, oh my God, this thing is free. I do it sitting on my sofa and the amount of value it brings me. And it's like, this is all I have to do, right? Now, it took me a while to get going and to get into it. And then I was so passionate about it. I said, you know, in what I do, corporate world, in what I do, we're going to talk about meditation and I'm going to bring it there. And I'm going to go there and I'm going to talk about it as one of your tools in your toolbox, right? For your self-awareness. So I bring it into my work now, but absolutely top thing I've done.
Love that. I'm going to give you 1 million euro, but you can only invest it in one person or company. Who are you picking?
I really struggle with this one. It's going to be female-led company, obviously. Now, I have two right now that I adore that I'm very close to, which is Peachy Lean, Sharon Keegan's company. And I have another company, Ella and Joe, another female-led company up in Galway. So I'm sorry, I'm going to have to go 50-50. I'm sorry, Gary.
Rule breaker.
I'm sorry, okay, I broke the rule on you. I'm sorry.
500K coming to them. Peach. Keep an eye out on your PayPal.
Sorry.
Right. If you start a brand new company in the morning, what would it be?
It would definitely be in my area of passion, which is somehow scaling this new paradigm in leadership development, which I feel very passionate about for the world, to be quite honest, right? That we're in, for the era that we're in, for the people, you know, for, you know, I think in this AI era, the roles that people do in organizations versus what they do now is going to be very different. I think the style of leadership is going to need to be very different. This is going to be driven. What I'm talking about, the P&L will drive it, right? I'd love that it was just human soul drove it, which I don't think it will, but the P&L will drive this new paradigm of leadership. So I would set up something to scale that.
Okay. What do you believe that other people would strongly disagree with or find strange?
I think they might disagree with my belief that there's soul and strategy.
Soul and strategy.
Soul plus strategy, I call the formula, right?
That's the name of the new company.
Yeah, soul plus strategy, done. It happened here today, Gary. And what do I mean by that? Look, I started out in the world as a woman, now very much operating more in my masculine energy. Believe it or not, I learned something, Gary, along the way, that all of us have female and masculine energies. And unfortunately, that's what they're called, because we're also called males and females from our sex. So it's like, oh, it's a bit confusing that this, these energies call the same thing. So I wish they were called something else. So I really started out because I was in the man's world, you know, it was heavily dominated by men. And I executed my masculine energy, right, in that comfortably in that environment. And I rose to the top of it and all of the rest. But I learned along the way that all of us have this female energy, which is my intuition, is my creativity, is my empathy, is my ability to have self-awareness, is my ability to strategize from that side of my being, as well as my masculine energy. I'd write you a strategy any day. You want something executed? I'm the woman, the machine. Yeah, that's my masculine side, right? Absolutely. But I have this other side, and it's much more in touch with, but if you want to call it your soul, the thing we talked about, who's observing, right? So I believe we align both of those. Both of those, and we're in our zone of genius. So, and we execute strategy from that place, and we'll be much more successful. And I'd say lots of people would strongly disagree with that.
That's what we want. We want to stimulate debate. What's one thing in your personal life do you spend money on that brings you immense joy?
Oh my God, I started it about 6 months ago, and I'm going, why did I wait this long? Weight training. A personal training.
I was dying to see what you're going to say there. You built it up lovely. Yeah. I'm a massive fan.
Oh my God.
Every day.
I'm like, yeah. Everybody. And it's down in Kilcool, our friends, Nike Fit.
Yeah.
Because we're neighbours now, we know, Gary. And I do three times a week with a personal training group of five of us. And I do weightlifting. And I cannot tell you.
Did Sharon get you into that?
No, Sharon is an incredible weightlifter, right?
Yeah.
So I was obviously watching her, and then others were inspiring me. So Sharon and others. And I'm telling you, it is something I now spend money on that brings me immense joy.
It's life changing.
It's life changing.
You're talking about the mental game as well?
And
those
feel so
two
strong.
Connect. Yeah.
That's the word. Every time I come out, I go, well, you get the endorphins and all that every time you do
it's
it.
Amazing.
So you get all that. So that's my one at the moment.
Great one. 100% on board with that. What's your final piece of advice for every entrepreneur listening?
My piece of advice is do not tie your whole identity about who you are to your business. You're way more than that. Way more. Look at your entire life, all the component parts of it, you know, and all of what you bring to the world above and beyond your business. Because I think it loosens the reins for us on the concept of failing, right? You're just way more than that.
That's a beautiful ending, because when you think of it, when you hold on so tight to something, you almost squeeze it to death. But when you loosen the reins a little, suddenly you breathe a little bit easier. You don't take it as seriously and you just breathe. Fiona, that was a beautiful conversation. That's what I can only describe that as. That was phenomenal. Thank you so much for being so open and so just honest about your journey and your journey now. Where can people connect with you or learn more about the digital mindset?
So they can connect with me through LinkedIn, Fiona O'Carroll LinkedIn. And also, of course, I forgot to mention, if for female entrepreneurs, if they're interested, Shara and I have a podcast which talks about more the inner critic side of the fence. And that's called Shedding Skin and Blisters. And you'll get that on Spotify, Apple, YouTube.
I will link it in the show notes as well.
Great.
Fiona, thank you so much.
Pleasure, Gary. Thank you so much. I so enjoyed the conversation.
If you enjoyed that chat with Fiona, hit subscribe, whether you're listening on Spotify, Apple, or YouTube. And I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode. Thanks for listening.